ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hi, and welcome to Rear Vision. I'm Ros Bluett. Today's program, Cuba and the USA.
You know, all my life I've been hearing about the United States and Cuba. When will the United States do it? I do believe I'll be having the honor of taking Cuba.
Trump himself has said that he's accomplishing what no other president before him was able to accomplish. So he has already begun to brag.
Just 90 miles separate the backyards of Cuba and the United States. And unfortunately, it's been an unfriendly relationship for 66 years. And Cuba's Latin American neighbours aren't interfering.
But most countries are remaining silent because they're afraid. They've seen what the administration has done in Venezuela and what it's doing in Iran. They see what it's doing to Cuba, and they're simply afraid to do anything to offend the United States at this moment.
In 1959, Fidel Castro transformed Cuba into a socialist state. And ever since then, American presidents have been trying to undo it. Now it's Donald Trump's turn, and he's determined to succeed. Today on Rear Vision, US presidents and why so many have used Cuba as the quintessential American football, and how Cuba has resisted for 66 years. We start in 1933, the year Franklin D. Roosevelt took presidential office. That same year, popular Democratic president Ramon Grau St. Martin was elected in Cuba. Associate lecturer at Western Sydney University, James Trapani, takes the story from here.
The Cuban state, in its brief democratic interlude under Ramon Grau St. Martin and then Carlos Prio, were seen as being vulnerable to communism because they didn't ban communism in the way that the United States expected. But for a president like Franklin Roosevelt, it was about using economic assistance and aid to support regimes which would support US interests in the region, rather than, as previous administrations had done, use the US military. Franklin Roosevelt realized that Latin American countries did not like having US soldiers on their territory.
Roosevelt called this policy the good neighbor policy. In other words, we're going to leave you alone. Now, just because the United States doesn't want to be the policeman of the Western Hemisphere doesn't mean the United States is promoting liberal democracies.
Columbia University's Tim Naftali is also CNN's presidential historian. Franklin Roosevelt promoted strongman Fulgencio Batista, and the 34th U.S. president, Dwight Eisenhower, followed.
The Eisenhower administration saw Batista as a trustworthy ally in the fight against communism in the Western Hemisphere. Americans and Canadians would go to Cuba for their honeymoons. The mob owned casinos in Havana. So it was a playground, not just for the American rich, but for North American middle class folks. These interests didn't own Batista, but he certainly benefited from that money flowing into the country.
He is allowing for U.S. citizens to buy property, to farm, and to create an export economy which is completely reliant on sales to the United States of America. The concentration of land by corporations like the United Fruit Company, who mostly made sugar, and the Kleborg Cattle Company out of Texas, that was taking away opportunities for things like subsistence agriculture. People working in farming were not seeing any benefits.
In fact, the major beneficiaries of the Cuban economy were American companies and the Batista regime, from sugar and mining to banking and real estate.
And it took the United States too long to recognize that the Batista regime was not only corrupt, but rotten to the core, and was liable to be overturned by a popular revolution.
They are in an exultant mood. Hundreds of thousands rally at the call of revolutionary leader Fidel Castro, who estimated their number at 1 million as the man who overthrew the Batista dictatorship.
Batista eventually flees Cuba for the Dominican Republic in 1959. The Cuban Revolution, it's one of many revolutions against authoritarian dictatorships that happen in Latin America. We see Peru overthrow Manuel Odría in 1956. We see Venezuela overthrow Pérez Jiménez in 1958. We see effectively a rejection of these strongman US-backed dictatorships across the region. And Cuba was one of many revolutions that initially looked like that.
So what was different about the Cuban Revolution and Fidel Castro? Tim Naftali explains by drawing a comparison with Yugoslavia and General Tito.
If Fidel had become a Tito, in other words, had been willing to be a communist but without a revolutionary edge and then not been interested in the international revolution, maybe the United States could have been friendly with a communist Cuba the way it was friendly with a communist Yugoslavia. But Fidel was committed to international revolution. Cuba sent revolutionaries to the Dominican Republic, and then they sent them to Angola, sent them to Grenada, they sent them to Nicaragua, they sent them to El Salvador. So on that basis, there was really no room for relationship with the United States.
And Fidel Castro didn't waste any time making domestic changes as well.
What they do in 1959 is it's modeled after the New Deal in the United States of America. Better prices for utilities, and most importantly, it's land reform. And land reform means taking land from foreign companies to give it to peasants to make their own food. This is the start of the big disagreement between the Eisenhower administration and Fidel Castro, which leads to the reduction of the sugar quota and then eventually the complete embargo of sugar coming out of Cuba.
In March of 1960, a year after Fidel comes to power, President Eisenhower, as we know from declassified records, instructed the intelligence community and diplomats to find a way to overthrow Castro. And eventually that involved an embargo.
By mid-1960, Cuba was running out of options and the Soviet Union offered help, obviously, to further their own objectives in Latin America. This was not altruism coming out of the Soviet Union. So the Soviet Union provide a market for sugar. In exchange, they start providing oil and other important commodities for the Cuban economy.
And the national mood greatly improves.
What should be kept in mind is how unique Fidel was. A leader of a Spanish-speaking revolution had the capacity, or the opportunity at least, to influence millions of people. And Fidel was remarkably charismatic. So many people were living in such economic and political despair in the Western Hemisphere that his message was a source of hope and inspiration.
Y de todos será la victoria, patria o muerte, venceremos.
So when Kennedy comes to power in early 1961, he's warned by one of his close advisors, Adolf Berl, that if Cuba is not isolated from Latin American politics, six countries could go the way of Cuba within 12 months. Very quickly, the Soviet Union have a foothold in Latin America. So Kennedy's strategy, and the Bay of Pigs is sort of a weird example in this timeline.
Kennedy inherited a project to overthrow Castro. It had been started by the previous government. Kennedy did not stop it. Kennedy could have stopped it. And Kennedy had come into office promising to bear any burden and pay any price to defeat communism. He did not see Castro as a military threat. He saw him as an ideological threat. And the great concern the Americans had was the Soviets would use Cuba as a base. And then it would be a military threat. But Cuba as Cuba was not a military threat to the United States.
But ironically, John F. Kennedy's failed Bay of Pigs invasion in April 1961 to overthrow Castro created the military threat he'd been wanting to avoid. It pushed the USSR and Cuba closer together. And in 1962, Nikita Khrushchev agreed to send nuclear weapons to Cuba. Kennedy narrowly resolved the ensuing Cuban Missile Crisis and then had to figure out another strategy to get the upper hand with Fidel.
That helped motivate John F. Kennedy to put forward an American alternative to Fidelismo.
Kennedy's strategy was to appeal to the good graces of the Latin American people, to say that we are on your side and we will support you through economic assistance. He eventually calls this the Alliance for Progress. $20 billion of loans from the United States to Latin Americans in exchange for removing Cuba from the Organization of American States. But Cuba is kicked out of the Organization of American States at the end of January 1962.
Following Kennedy, Presidents Lyndon Johnson and Richard Nixon gave up on Cuba invasion plans but kept other Latin American countries in close orbit.
Lyndon Johnson stopped the efforts to overthrow Cuba in 1964. The embargo stayed. Nixon followed the policy of containing Fidel. So when Fidel's friend Salvador Allende won a democratic election in Chile, the United States wanted him out. But in terms of Fidel, the U.S. basically maintained the embargo and otherwise left him alone.
U.S. policy has oscillated back and forth depending upon whether it's a Democrat or a Republican in the White House.
Professor William Leo Grand specializes in U.S. policy in Central America. He takes up the story from Jimmy Carter's presidency in 1977.
Carter had many negotiations with the Cuban government, hoping to normalize the relationship. But when Ronald Reagan replaced Carter, he declared Cuba a state sponsor of international terrorism. He provided enormous military assistance to revolutionary movements in Central America, particularly in El Salvador and Guatemala, and at the same time tried to overthrow the Sandinista government in Nicaragua. And he blamed all of Central America's turmoil on the Cubans. George H.W. Bush was not much better. He did his best to get the Soviet Union to halt aid to Cuba during the period of Gorbachev before the Soviet Union collapsed.
The problem for Cuba, which remains their problem today, is they don't have a source of oil. The Soviets provided them with cheap oil because Cuba was a showcase of communism. But Cuba was completely dependent on Soviet oil. The Cubans suffered a tremendous crisis when the Soviet Union collapsed. The Soviets kept Cuba's economy afloat.
You're listening to Rear Vision on Radio National. I'm Ros Bluett, and today we're looking at Cuba, its relationship with the United States, and why it's now again in troubled waters. US-Cuba policy has ricocheted from president to president. In December 1991, when the Soviet Union collapsed, so did the cheap oil to Cuba. It started looking elsewhere, but as per US foreign policy, Cuba was still isolated from its Latin American neighbours.
The embargo remained under the Bush and Clinton administrations. Cuba no longer had the support of the Soviet Union. Their economy is in very deep trouble, and a lot of Cubans start to protest. Millions of Cubans make their way across to the United States in the 1990s. It was believed by the Clinton administration that Cuba would collapse in the 1990s, but Cuba just doesn't fall. It just keeps going.
The Cubans built a police state. It was a tightly controlled society with an economy that was a planned economy which couldn't sustain itself without the help of a petrostate.
And luckily for Cuba, there was another willing petrostate not too far away. Venezuela's new leader, Hugo Chavez, put out the hand of friendship.
Hugo Chavez adored Fidel. Fidel was his idol. If you look at photographs of these two men, you can see Chavez with adoring eyes looking at Fidel. So Chavez did everything he could to keep the Castro experiment alive.
Venezuela starts selling oil to Cuba. And then eventually, by the late 2000s, so 2009 to 2010, he starts giving Cuba oil for free in exchange for thousands of Cuban doctors who open up medical clinics in Venezuela. And this allows the growth of the Cuban economy again, a revitalization of the Cuban economy, which leads U.S. President Barack Obama to eventually declare that the embargo has been a failure.
When what you're doing doesn't work for 50 years, it's time to try something new. And our shift in Cuba policy has the potential to end the legacy of mistrust in our hemisphere. It removes a phony excuse for restrictions in Cuba, stands up for democratic values, and extends the hand of friendship to the Cuban people.
President Obama, even during his first campaign, indicated that he wanted to open a dialogue with Cuba to see if the relationship couldn't be improved. But in 2014, he and Cuban President Raul Castro announced a really historic shift, reopening diplomatic relations that had been cut in 1961 and promising to move toward the full normalization of relations between the two countries.
The Cuban flag has been raised in Washington, D.C. for the first time in 54 years. The U.S. and Cuba have finally restored diplomatic ties, putting aside decades of
hostility. We are ending a policy that was long past its expiration date.
One of the first things that Obama did was to take Cuba off the state sponsors of terrorism list because they didn't belong there in the first place. And from there, the two countries were able to negotiate 22 bilateral agreements on issues of mutual interest over the course of just the next 24 months.
He allows, for example, tourists to go to Cuba. You'd never been allowed to be a U.S. citizen and go to Cuba before Obama. But all of a sudden, millions of tourists, mostly from the U.S., but also from Western Europe and even from Australia, were going to Cuba and they were spending money.
Then Republican Donald Trump won the next U.S. election in 2016.
But Donald Trump systematically began to undo all the things, or almost all the things, that Obama had achieved. He also left the Paris Climate Accords. He left the nuclear agreement with Iran. He just wanted to undo the work of his predecessor. The second reason was that Trump had promised during the campaign that he would reverse Obama's Cuba policy. He did that to attract support from Cuban American voters in Florida in the hopes that that would help him to carry that state in the election.
Trump did win the state of Florida in the next election, but lost overall to Democrat Joe Biden in 2020.
Joe Biden promised that he would return to Obama's policy. President Biden left most of the Trump sanctions in place until the very, very end of his administration, when in the last week of his presidency, he took Cuba off the terrorism list again, because Trump had put them back on, and he suspended some sanctions against Cuba. But of course, as soon as Trump came back, he just undid everything that Biden had waited until the last minute to do. Most of the changes that Biden had announced never even went into effect because Trump reversed them so fast.
Early in his second term, Donald Trump set his sights on Latin America and the Caribbean, Venezuela and Cuba in particular. In Venezuela, Nicolas Maduro succeeded Hugo Chavez and kept oil flowing to Cuba in exchange for health and education services.
Maduro continued the assistance to Cuba. And when the United States, or let's say the Trump administration, kidnapped Maduro, brought him back to the United States to face charges, the one U.S. demand was that Venezuela no longer provide oil to Cuba, and Venezuela has followed that demand.
Venezuela cut off oil shipments to Cuba and sent the doctors home. Subsequent to that,
President Trump signed an executive order threatening to impose tariffs on any other country that sent any oil to Cuba. So it's effectively an oil blockade on the island. Well, obviously, a modern country can't function without petroleum. So Cuba's been plunged into periodic, extensive blackouts where most parts of the country don't have lights most of the day, every day. Sanctions that Trump has imposed on Cuba have really brought the island to the brink of a humanitarian crisis.
The Cubans are all alone. They're back in the worst economic crisis that they've experienced since the end of the Cold War.
So what's the current U.S. president's end game here?
Well, Trump has always been a supporter of the Cuban-American dream of overthrowing the Cuban government. Marco Rubio, testifying before Congress, explicitly said that they wanted to see regime change in Cuba.
The Venezuela operation went so smoothly, from his perspective, that he thought, okay, now let's do Iran, and then let's do Cuba. It's not a strategy. It's a, to say whimsical is wrong, because whimsy implies something rather positive and amusing, and this is not positive and it's not amusing. But it's an impulsive approach to using power. And he has people around him who have long wanted to see a regime change in Cuba.
But our focus right now is on Iran. I would say, what will you do? Take about 2 days off, Marco? No, he won't. Maybe an hour. He'll take 1 hour off and then he'll finish up a deal on Cuba.
The U.S. is now intervening in countries and leaving in place the bad regime that the U.S. was complaining about. Now, we don't know what's going to happen in Iran, but in Venezuela, the people who are in control are the same people that were implementing Maduro's approaches. And it doesn't look to me like the United States is actually dictating very much other than control over the oil sector.
Current reports swing between regime change and closed-door negotiations. Castro's relatives seem to be playing a role. But to change the regime, William Leogrand says, there needs to be a viable alternative.
I think even the Trump administration acknowledges that there's no organized opposition in Cuba that could take over from the government. And that's why they're actually negotiating to try and reach some kind of agreement with the current government. There is a lot of discontent with the government's managing of the economy because the Cuban economy has been in crisis ever since the pandemic. But anytime anybody tries to actually organize an opposition against the government, that is suppressed. So most of the people over the last few years that have tried to organize opposition to the government are living today either in Miami or Madrid.
There are moments when Trump is looking just for trophies, for awards. And for him, the trophy could simply be having the president of Cuba resign. That might be it for him. I don't think he really cares. He's not that interested in follow through. Donald Trump doesn't have a strategy. It looks like they're just breaking things and moving on.
So last December, Pete Hegseth gave a speech.
For far too long, our country's gaze was only on borders in far-flung places. Not our own border, not our own hemisphere, not the Western Hemisphere. President Trump has established the Trump corollary of the Monroe Doctrine, the Donroe Doctrine. And the War Department is implementing it as fast as we can.
Trump's new national security strategy is very clear that the strategy is to restore the dominance of the United States in the Western Hemisphere and explicitly to reduce the influence of extra-hemispheric powers, specifically Russia and China. The idea that the United States is going to kick China out of the Western Hemisphere is really a pipe dream, precisely because the United States is not prepared to replace China as an economic partner with the region.
And the irony in all this is that as the U.S. starves Cuba of oil, China has stepped up its assistance to Cuba, providing it with green energy infrastructure. Cuba is aiming to have 30% of its energy produced by renewable sources by 2030 and is well on track to achieving it.
If the principal demand of the United States is for some kind of economic opening to U.S. businesses, then that's something that the Cubans would entertain, I think. And after all, in Venezuela, that is what Trump has been most interested in, not in a transition to Venezuelan democracy, but rather simply securing concessions for U.S. oil companies to access Venezuelan oil reserves. If he takes the same approach in Cuba to open up the Cuban tourist sector to U.S. investors, open up strategic mineral mining to U.S. investors, then I think there is a basis for an agreement. But if he's going to demand that the Cubans change their political system because the United States insists on it, they're not going to do that.
He's probably thinking, does it help me to topple Cuba or not before November? That's the way he thinks. Is it a win or not? He thought Iran would be an easy win, and it's not. When they started this, they assumed, and I don't know why, but they assumed that Iran would be another Venezuela.
It's difficult to predict where the US president will take us next, what he'll say, and how seriously he'll pursue his intervention in Cuba.
I really do think that this particular intervention against Cuba is about Donald Trump's legacy and not about a particular security threat coming out of the island of Cuba. It's more about finishing, you know, 66 years of US-Cuban hostility, and Donald Trump would very much like to be the president who was able to bring an end to that. This is more about history than it is about current geopolitical issues.
Many agree that Donald Trump would like to see his name go down in the history books, which it certainly will. But if it's regime change in Cuba that the 47th US president is insisting on, William Leo Grand has a word of warning.
I think this is a vanity project for President Trump. Certainly it does not serve the national interest of the United States. It would create chaos in Cuba, probably a massive migration crisis. It would open the door to a platform for transnational crime only 90 miles from the United States. It would reopen narcotics trafficking routes through the Caribbean, which Cuba has helped us to close. It would create a humanitarian disaster on the island, and there would be enormous pressure from Cuban Americans for direct U.S. military intervention to restore order and save their families on the island. In some ways, the worst outcome for U.S. national interest would be if this policy succeeded at overthrowing the Cuban government.
Professor William Leo Grand, author of Back Channel to Cuba, The Hidden History of Negotiations Between Washington and Havana, ending today's program. You also heard Timothy Neftali, historian and senior research fellow at Columbia University's School of International and Public Affairs, and James Trapani, associate lecturer in Western Sydney University's School of Arts. Today's sound engineer was Roy Huberman. I'm Ros Bluett, and you've been listening to Rear Vision. Thanks for your company.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.